Hello, everyone. I'm Ronnie McBrayer, and I thank you for finding my podcast. Here you will find my regular talks, the occasional interview, hopefully a little light from the Enneagram time to time, and hear conversations with friends on the ever-changing, ever-evolving nature of faith. If you are burned out on religion, to quote Eugene Peterson's marvelous paraphrase, but your faith is still important to you, or if you consider yourself a spiritual exile with no real place of belief to call home, then I have you especially in mind, and I hope you'll stick around.
Last night as I was sleeping, I dreamed that a spring was breaking out in my heart. Oh, water, are you coming to me? Water of life that I have never drunk. Last night as I was sleeping, I dreamed that I had a beehive here inside my heart, and the golden bees were making combs of sweet honey from all of my old failures. Last night as I was sleeping, I dreamed that a fiery sun was giving light inside my heart. It was fiery because I felt warmth as from a hearth, and sun because it gave light and brought tears to my eyes. Last night, as I was sleeping, I dreamed that it was God I had here inside my heart. That is a poem written by Spanish poet Antonio Machado. He was born in 1875, and either by fate or the accident of his birth, would live through some of Spain's most tumultuous years. As a child, he witnessed the overthrow of the Spanish monarchy. He would grow up in chaos and disintegration, seeing Spain lose its grip over all of its international territories, and then in midlife be plunged into the Spanish Civil War, forced across the border into France to avoid capture and execution by the fascist and nationalistic dictator Francisco Franco, a fate that 500,000 people did not escape. Machado's avoidance didn't last long. Just days after crossing the border, he died of pneumonia and the traumas of the war. He was never sad, however. By his own testimony, he was elegant with his words and with his approachability, again saying as much, quote, "I am a simple man seeking the eternal values of love, justice, understanding, and freedom. I wish sometimes that I was a poet. If I was, I would hope I could write with the style and grace of Machado." Another of his poems, "I have walked down many roads. I have walked down many roads and cleared many paths. I have navigated 100 oceans and anchored off 100 shores. All over I have seen caravans of sadness, pompous and melancholy men drunk with black shadows and defrocked legalists who stare, keep quiet, and think they know because they don't drink wine in the neighborhood bars. Bad people who go around polluting the earth. And all over I have seen people who dance or play when they can, and they work their four handfuls of land. If they turn up someplace, they never ask where they are. When they travel, they ride on the backs of old mules and don't know how to hurry. When there's wine, they drink wine. When there's no wine, they drink water. These are good people who live, work, get by, and dream. And on a day like all the others, they lie down under the earth." And one more, a poem you will become familiar with, I hope, over the next few weeks. It is called "The Path is Made by Walking." Everything passes on, and everything remains. But our lot is to pass on, to go on making paths. Traveler, there is no path. The path is made by walking. By walking, the path is made, beat by beat and verse by verse. And when you look back, you'll see a road never to be trodden again. Traveler, there is no path, only trails across the sea, beat by beat and verse by verse. When the goldfinch cannot sing, when the poet is a pilgrim, when prayer will do us no good. Traveler, there is no path. The path is made by walking, beat by beat and verse by verse. Will you walk the path with me this morning from the city of Jerusalem to the tiny, mysterious village of Emmaus? Or at least join me on the road, because we won't get to our destination today. But as sure as the path is made by walking, you also know that a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. And though there are only 11 kilometers in the King and Queen's English between start and finish, about 7 miles, there is so much, much further distance than that. I've been walking on this road for a year now, and I haven't gotten anywhere. So I'm going to see if you will help me. In 2003, 2 weeks after Easter, just like today, I came to this text in the lectionary. And I said to you that day that it had seized me, and that one day I would love to come back to this story and spend more than a single Sunday morning with it. And since then, I have read and reread and bathed in this story over and over again. It has been the longest 7 miles of my life. And I say that without complaint. It is almost an infinite journey, what we read in these few paragraphs. And my only disappointment is the lack of depth and reflection that I have found around this account from those I typically read for a little insight. The great biblical commentator William Barclay says, and I quote, "This is one of the immortal short stories of the world." Wow. And I agree, but then that's about all he says. He gives it no justice at all, blaming the setting sun on these poor pilgrims' inability to recognize Jesus, and makes a few bullet points to portray Jesus as the great explainer and not much else. Leon Morris, a renowned New Testament scholar, called the Emmaus Road a, quote, charming story, one of the best loved of all the resurrection narratives. Yes, yes, yes. And then in his vast commentary, he gives 1% of his words to that account. Vintage Matthew Henry, whose commentary has been a staple on preachers' shelves for 300 years, gives the account a great amount of space, pages and pages, but he rambles on about so many other things in the process, he doesn't even talk about the story at hand. And John Calvin, the Protestant reformer, he wrote 75 massive books on the Bible. He gives this story 12 paragraphs, and most of it is commentary on the Old Testament. And so it goes. I'm not being critical of these writers, and I don't want others to do my thinking for me. The point that I am making is that indeed, this is one of the immortal short stories of the world. This is one of the best loved of all the resurrection narratives. This story is a true gift, a genuine treasure, authentically inspired. It has been given for every true believer, for every spiritual seeker, for every honest doubter, for every troubled questioner, for every wanderer and wonderer, for every curious soul, every longing heart, every disillusioned cause keeper, every disappointed lover. It is a tale told for the freshie just beginning her walk of faith, for the cynic who has lost his faith, for the agnostic who interrogates faith, for the atheist who has no faith, and for the old hand, the old road-weary traveler who is just trying to keep the faith. And after a year with this story as my regular contemplative partner, I recognize that these 7 miles from Jerusalem to Emmaus cover the distance of eternity. I recognized that these few verses might be the most creative use of narrative anywhere in the Christian lexicon, as Luke, the writer, brings together Jewish wisdom, emerging Christian reflection, metaphor, parable, and borrows from both Plato and Socrates to tell his story. I recognize that this gold mine has gone largely unmined, and I recognize that I am not up to the task of trying to communicate all that is here. I hardly know what I'm saying today, much less next week or the week after that. I am hanging on by my fingernails, and that, frankly, is just usually not my jam, man. More than 30 years, I have been preaching sermons, giving Sunday talks. That's long enough to know how to put a series of related talks together. It should be long enough. You attack the subject matter and the text ferociously. You read every commentary from every agreeing and conflicting perspective. You take copious notes. You research, you think, you sleep on it, you wake with it, you come to know it. It takes hours, it takes days, it takes weeks, it takes months. You lay out your plan, your little speaking calendar. You build it like an engineer in some cases, or you paint it like an artist dealing with a canvas in others. And the most common question I've been asked over these 30 plus years is this: how long does it take you to prepare a sermon? My oldest mentor, Jether Cochran, gave me the answer at my ordination with this charge: Ronnie, you spend an hour in preparation for every minute of presentation. And that has been my rule of thumb over all of these years. And I don't share that to prove to you how studious I am, or how well read, or whatever. But I do want you to know that I care. I want you to know that if you're going to take the time to be here, I'm going to take the time to be ready and to have something worth saying. It is better to have something to say than to have to say something. Now, 25 hours or so goes into a Sunday talk. I'm not saying that everyone needs that kind of time. I do. And yes, there are those moments, those weeks, where the talk comes to you and it's quick and it's fast, and all you have to do is write it down on paper as quickly as you can. Oh, I pray to God that that happened more often. And then sometimes it's like Pablo Picasso. Picasso lived in France most of his life. One day, Picasso is painting in a park, and a woman sees him there and recognizes him, and somehow she convinces him to make a portrait of her. So he takes his pencil, makes a portrait of her, hands it to her. She says, "How much do I owe for this art?" And he says, 5,000 francs, the equivalent today of about $30,000. And she's angry. And she says, 5,000 francs? It only took you 5 minutes to draw that. And he just reached over and took it back from her and said, "Madam, it didn't take me 5 minutes to draw that. It took my whole life. And it has taken me not just a year to walk this road to Emmaus. It has taken me what feels like my entire life. I can't even begin to say what I see, hear, feel, and sense in this story personally, much less all that is here. But as any preacher who is worth his salt would say, it's not going to stop me from trying. It will take more than today. It will take more than next week or the week after that. But I ask you again, will you walk the path with me from the city of Jerusalem to the tiny, mysterious village of Emmaus, or at least join me on the road, because we won't get to our destination today. But as sure as the path is made by walking, a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. And it's not 7 miles. It's so much further than that. And yes, I wish I could find the words to capture it. 40 years ago, Carl Sagan, the famed astronomer and scientist, wrote a novel on his favorite subject, extraterrestrials. I told Tim today, this morning early, I was texting him, and Tim loves everything about aliens, just so you know. And I said to him, Tim, I'm tipping my hat to you today. There's just a brief allusion to extraterrestrials. And he said, I'll sit on the front row with a tinfoil hat. I can hardly wait. The novel was entitled Contact. And it was adapted into a movie a decade later, starring Jodie Foster as a scientist and a young Matthew McConaughey as a minister and religious philosopher. Foster is in search of intelligent life in outer space, and she finds what she is looking for. Otherworldly creatures send her thousands of pages of encoded data, data that instructs Earthlings to build a giant machine. And this machine will transport a person through a wormhole, defying space and time, to meet those apparently friendly aliens on the other side. I nominate Tim Riles to go. Foster enters the machine and the quantum gateway, and she has a deeply emotional, spiritual, yea, religious experience. She is transported to another world, making contact, but no one will believe her. They haven't had her experience, an experience that cannot be documented or verified. And in a pivotal scene, in the aftermath of her journey, she is interrogated by some governmental committee. And they say this, you come to us with no evidence, no record, no artifacts. You come to us with only a story. Why don't you withdraw your testimony and concede that this journey never took place? And this is her answer. She says, because I can't. I had an experience. I can't prove it. I can't even explain it. But I was giving something wonderful, something that has changed me forever, a vision of the universe that tells us undeniably how tiny and insignificant and how rare and precious we all are. A vision that tells us that we belong to something that is greater than ourselves, that we are not, that none of us are alone. I wish I could share that. I wish that everyone, if only for one moment, could feel that awe and humility and hope. And in the immersive moment of her experience, she concedes that she was the wrong person to make contact. Weeping, she says, I have no words to describe it. They should have sent a poet. I had no idea. I suspect that if we could interrogate these two unknown travelers on the road to Emmaus, joined by the risen Christ on their way, they would say something very similar. You come to us with no evidence, no record, no artifacts, only a story. And they might say, we had an experience. We can't prove it. We can't explain it, but we were given something wonderful, something that has changed us forever. A vision of the universe that tells us undeniably how tiny and insignificant and how rare and precious we all are. A vision that tells us that we belong to something that is greater than ourselves, that we are not, that none of us are alone. That's how I feel about this story. And I'm glad a poet was there to capture it. Luke, that is. The finest and most skilled wordsmith of the New Testament, who loved both a good story and putting his feet to the path for the next horizon. And here these two loves collide in a celestial event. And I wish, I pray, I aspire to share that. I wish that everyone, if only for one moment, could feel the awe, the humility, and the hope I feel with this single story. But all I can do is share it. As Walt Whitman said, and the poets are best here, not I, not anyone else can travel this road for you. You must travel it for yourself. Stop this day and night with me. You shall no longer take these things at second or third hand. You shall not look through my eyes either, nor take things from me. You shall listen to all and filter them for yourself. I tramp a perpetual journey. Come listen, all. My signs are a rainproof coat, good shoes, and a staff cut from the woods. No friend of mine takes ease in my chair. I have no chair, no church, no philosophy. I lead no man to a dinner table, library, or exchange. But each man and each woman of you I lead to the hill, my left hand around your waist, my right hand pointing to landscapes of continents and pointing to the road. Not I, not anyone else can travel that road for you. You must travel it for yourself. It is not far. It is within your reach. Perhaps you have been on this road since you were born and you did not know it. Perhaps it is everywhere, on water and on land. Shoulder your duds, my dear son, and I will shoulder mine, and let us hasten forth. You are asking me questions, and I hear you, but I cannot answer. You must find out for yourself. So sit a while, my dear. Here are biscuits to eat and milk to drink, but as soon as you sleep and renew yourself, I will kiss you with a goodbye kiss and open the gate. Long enough have you dreamed your dreams. Now wash the sleep from your eyes. Habit yourself to the dazzle of the light and to every moment of your God-given life.